This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott.
The American economy.
Climate change without.
Hacking.
Different religions in it.
Sustainability.
Social media.
Security. Freedom.
Technology.
Marriage.
Essentially ethics.
Privacy.
Today we continue our Rethink 2014 series with a whole new look at the Catholic Church. In keeping with tradition, last March, the election of a new pope was heralded with a billow of white smoke. 9 months later, Pope Francis has rejected many other customs of his office, while the media remain in a kind of papal haze. Time magazine and the gay and lesbian publication The Advocate both named Pope Francis their person of the year. Francis also topped Esquire's list of 2013's best-dressed men, and the list-happy BuzzFeed jumped on the papal bandwagon with the 19 best Pope Francis moments of 2013. Between ditching the Popemobile and taking a frugal approach to papal garb, it is easy to see why visits to the Vatican have tripled since Francis became pontiff. But do the declarations of a seemingly reformist pope signal a new era for the Roman Catholic Church, an institution more than 2,000 years old? Rethink 2014 picks up that question with Father James Martin, author of The Jesuit Guide to Almost Everything and chaplain of the Colbert Report. Reverend James Martin, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. My pleasure to be here.
All right. Chaplain of the Colbert Report. What does that mean? And did that have to be decided by a special convocation?
No, there was no conclave needed. I've been on that show, I guess, about 6 or 7 times. And I guess the second or third time, Stephen Colbert pronounced me the official chaplain, and I accepted. So my ministries are pretty circumscribed.
Who could say no? Well, not to immediately reveal your age, but you have lived through the papacy of John the 23rd, who opened the discussion of Vatican II, of Paul the 6th, have been a priest throughout the papacy of John Paul the 2nd, Pope Benedict, and now Francis. So you've got quite a perspective. Why are people so taken with Francis?
Well, that's a good question. I usually say that people just like him. I think they responded early on to a lot of the gestures that he did in terms of moving out of the Apostolic Palace, getting rid of the red shoes, driving around in a little car, and then also some of the things that he said, who am I to judge, when he was speaking about gay priests and later gay persons. I think they find him very accessible and inviting, too, when they hear him speak. So it's a combination of factors, and I think it's hard to put your finger on, but I think they find him very authentic.
Is his papacy a genuine departure? And maybe some examples of how he might compare to popes throughout the 20th and 21st centuries.
Well, it is and it isn't. It isn't in that he has not changed any church doctrine. He believes in the resurrection, the Trinity, those kinds of things. But it is in that he has done certain things, as I mentioned, that have changed the tone. And he's also changed the way that the pope lives. He's moved out of the Apostolic Palace. He drives his own car. He makes his own phone calls. He speaks in a different way. Remember, John Paul was primarily a philosopher, and Benedict was a theologian, and so they spoke in that language. Francis, as a former Jesuit and former archbishop, I think speaks as a pastor, speaks as a parish priest might speak in his homilies. And so in a sense, there's a different language that's being used that's coming out of the Vatican these days.
How about in that first encyclical, was that truly changing the focus to serve the poor rather than to become consumed by all of these big contentious issues in the church?
Well, once again, yes and no. The church has always, since its foundation 2,000 years ago, served the poor. And it is still, particularly in the developing world and in the inner city here in the United States, the primary way that a lot of people meet the church is through their outreach, to the poor. But he did say in an interview with us at America Magazine in September that we can't be obsessed with some of the things that the church has seemed to be obsessed with, gay marriage, birth control, abortion, those kinds of things. So he is saying, we need to look at, what has been historically, the foundation of one of the, main ministries, which is working with the poor. So he is trying to shift the focus a bit.
Well, those are the kind of actions that have made the world declare that this is an all new pope. And he has added a kind of layer of transparency to this cloaked mystery of an ancient institution. I'm wondering what that means inside of the church, how the Vatican is run, how Catholics regard themselves as members of the church. How do you think that's changed?
Well, any time that a Catholic, likes the Pope or feels connected to the Pope means that the the Catholic himself or herself feels more connected to the church. That's just, you know, sort of psychologically. But, you know, to your point, he also appointed, I think, KPMG and McKinsey to help out with the Vatican Bank. You know, there's more transparency there. He is someone who I think is ready to shake things up. And a friend of mine in Rome told me that one of the reasons the cardinals voted for him, this guy is a very, you know, sort of influential person himself, said that because they knew that he would be able to change things even in 3 or 4 years. Mm-hmm. You know, he's not afraid of anything. He's not afraid of shaking things up. And like a good Jesuit, he's very free. He doesn't worry about how things were done in the past. That's not as much of a concern to him.
Right. We hear a lot of the bold statements. How about internal statements that don't get as much attention? You know, how is he talking about the clergy? How is he talking about ordaining women as priests, for example?
Well, you know, one thing he said the other day, which was pretty shocking, was he gave a talk to the heads of men's religious orders. And he said, if we don't train people well, train them, you know, in their heart, you know, make them compassionate people, we would be creating, quote, little monsters, end quote.
Wow.
Which is, I mean, that is really strong, strong, strong language. And the other thing he did, which may have flown under some people's radar, is, you know, in the church we have this honorary title, Monsignor, for priests, usually giving to parish priests, but also people in the Vatican. He abolished that title for people under 65. That is, there will be no new Monsignors under the age of 65. That's a big change. I mean, it's taking away what he doesn't like, which is, you know, what's called clericalism within the church. So these are big internal changes that are really shaking things up.
All right. The internal changes aside, how about the rest of the world? I mean, there are a decade of stories of well-publicized stories about clerical abuse of children for the Catholic Church to deal with, a lot to make up for. How is he addressing the outside world?
Yeah, one of the things he did was to immediately create a commission, a high-level Vatican commission, to take a look at that and to the sexual abuse crisis and to put into, you know, sort of more formally what dioceses need to do, you know. So I think he's trying his best. It's a very difficult problem, and it's been dealt with, you know, a lot on the local level, but not as much on the Vatican level. So I think that's one thing that he's trying to do. He's trying to kind of raise it up and give it more, what would you say, kind of institutional oomph, you know, by putting it at that Vatican level.
As you alluded to, it seems like every week there is another story about Pope Francis. On New Year's Eve, we heard reports that he left a voicemail for a group of Spanish nuns. He secretly visited the homeless in Rome just around Christmas time. Stories that he used to ride a Harley-Davidson motorcycle, once a bouncer at a club in Argentina. Is this just a very well-calculated PR campaign?
No, I don't think he's – I mean, he's not calculating and he's not sort of putting these stories out there. They kind of leak out. You know, part of it is, you know, he's a Jesuit. I'm a Jesuit. Most Jesuits, you know, have had, you know, sort of lives before they entered the religious order. So, you know, I worked for GE. I mean, I, you know, had a different kind of career. And, you know, he was a bouncer. He did all sorts of things. So I think he's comfortable with showing people his background and his humanity. I think that phone call to the nuns was pretty funny. He's also someone with a good sense of humor, and he doesn't take himself very seriously at all.
What did he say to the nuns?
He said it was a group of Carmelite nuns who are cloistered, and he said, where are you nuns that you can't pick up the phone? You know, the answer is obviously praying, but it is pretty funny. And it was very good-natured, and he just called to wish them a happy new year. You know, he sent me a letter a couple months ago. I sent through a friend of mine some copies of my books in Spanish, and he sent me a letter, a personal note. And I mean, I almost fell off my chair.
Wow.
I mean, you know, well, you can imagine someone who, you know, is obviously very busy, you know, who takes the time to write out a handwritten note. So it's quite something. He's a very authentic and real person. I love the guy. I mean, I think he's just fantastic.
Well, you're not the only person who says it. I mean, in very anecdotal circles, people are talking about how much they love this pope. How about more conservative Catholics? How are they reacting?
Most of them, I think, like him a great deal. Most of them, I think, are happy to see the church, you know, portrayed in a more positive light. There are some people that are disturbed. He's speaking a lot about the poor. That is not to say that all conservative Catholics are having trouble with that, but I would say some are. And it's disturbing for a lot of people. But you know what? It should be disturbing. Jesus was disturbing. And one of the summary ways of looking at Catholicism is that as Catholics, we should comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. And that's what he's doing.
We're speaking with Father James Martin, author and editor-at-large of the magazine America. That's a Jesuit magazine. He also has the high distinction of being chaplain of the Colbert Report. We're talking about rethinking Catholicism, led largely by Pope Francis, and a series of very notable public actions and statements that are causing people to rethink the papal office. And that is a question. How deeply does this go, Reverend Martin? On one hand, you have Dan Savage, of all people, praising the Pope for saying, "Who am I to judge gay priests?" But then says he's disappointed to hear about gay adoption being allowed in Malta. Now, should this come to any surprise to us?
Well, by the same token, that second comment was reported by a bishop. The Pope said this to me. And so we didn't hear from the Pope directly. Later on, in that same talk to the heads of religious orders, he said he talked kind of warmly about the children of gay marriages, you know, who are adopted by gays and lesbians. And he said, you know, we can't inoculate them against the faith. In other words, we need to welcome them into the church, which was a very positive way of speaking about children, of gay couples. So, frankly, I thought that taken with the "who am I to judge" comment was very pastoral. The point is that, you know, we've not heard these kinds of words or that kind of tone coming from the Vatican before. "Who am I to judge" is quite different. I mean, those may be the five most famous words he'll ever say. I mean, that is a big change. He hasn't changed doctrine, but that is a significant change. And, you know, he was man of the year for The Advocate, the gay and lesbian magazine. And, you know, I always tell people the proof's in the pudding. Look how gays and lesbians are responding to him. That means something has changed.
Hmm. So this is one man, and we're looking at a very ancient and entrenched Roman Catholic hierarchy in many different places. How much can he actually accomplish when faced with such a huge worldwide organization that may disagree with him?
I think a lot. I think the cardinals and bishops. Now, remember, you have a lot of cardinals, archbishops, and bishops who are really on the ground, you know, with their people working in favelas and slums. And we tend in the West to think of cardinals and archbishops as, you know, guys who live in these very nice houses and things. But, you know, I worked in the developing world, and most of them don't. You know, they're living kind of very simply. But, you know, the Pope sets the tone. And so for cardinals and bishops and archbishops, they're taking their lead from him. I know a lot of them who have said to me that, wow, he's getting me to think about things in a different way. Some of them might be more kind of suspicious or wait and see. But most of them are saying, hey, this is my boss, basically, and I need to kind of, you know, see what he's inviting us into, which I think is fantastic.
Father James Martin of America Magazine, it's a Jesuit magazine, chaplain of the Colbert Report, and author of the upcoming book, Jesus, A Pilgrimage. Thank you very much for your time today.
My pleasure.
When Word of Mouth continues, we'll talk with the frontman of the Presidents of the United States of America. That's a band that made a whole lot of noise back in the 90s. Now he is making music for kids. We'll get a taste when Word of Mouth continues in just a minute.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott.
Six black cherries and the juice of a lime. Barbecue sauce and a grapefruit rind. One part water, six parts gin. A cup of mud and an octopus chin. Bubble.
You're listening to the song Electric Spider by the Presidents of the United States of America. The same band responsible for the 1995 hit single Lump is now releasing their sixth studio album this February, the first since 2008.
Spider, we're flying higher.
Over the past 6 years, President's frontman Chris Ballew has been keeping himself busy making music geared towards an entirely different generation of listeners, the 3- and 4-year-old set.
Highway sign, greasy spoon, CB radio, butterfly driving a truck.
Under the name Casper Baby Pants, Chris has released 7 albums of children's music, including a collection of Beatles tunes, all in the past 5 years. Given that the start of a new year is a time to reinvent for so many, we wanted to figure out what it's like to go from rocker to Raffy and then back again. So we invited him onto the show. Chris Ballew, thanks so much for being with us.
Ah, thanks for having me. It's nice to be here.
So what inspired you to make music for kids? I'm guessing it might have been having a kid.
Actually, no. It's funny. Well, my wife is a bit of a kid, although not in age, but in mentality. Not that she's damaged or anything. She's fine. But she is an artist, and she makes this incredibly well-crafted, bright, folksy, whimsical collage art full of animals. And I looked at that art and realized, you know what? I want to make music that sounds like that art looks. Hmm. Aside from the band, I had been sort of searching for a long, long time to find another voice that was quieter and more innocent and simpler, without really knowing what the purpose was going to be. So I see her art. I made a few songs to go along with a few pieces of her art. When I listened back, I realized it's kids' music. And I'm 7 records later, I'm still going strong.
Wow. So what is that difference that you talked about between making music for adults and for toddlers? Is it about writing or song structure or production?
You know, I look at it as sort of an energetic thing. You know, I tend to look at sort of the end product. Now, with the Presidents, my focus is on making a room full of people at a live show really come alive and smile and feel like they're in on the show and that we're no better than them in a fundamental kind of punk rock way. You could do this too. We're just like you. And with the Casper stuff, my real purpose is to give families music that they can all really honestly enjoy. You know, I want to take care of the parents' aesthetic needs and the children's aesthetic needs. And finding that balance is a real creative challenge.
I saw Hobo Baby leaving on a trip. Diaper for a suitcase sticking out his lip. Baby eats a berry, baby eats a plum. When that baby has nothing to eat, that baby sucks its thumb. Get along home, hobo baby, get along home, 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 get along home. Gonna cradle you someday, get along home, 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 get along home.
Well, here's one of those songs that could be shared, Hobo Baby. Pretty funny.
Oh, that's my wife's favorite Casper Baby Pants song.
Well, I'm gonna side with her on this one. And it's very funny in ways that a toddler may not necessarily understand. They'll just like it. Is the idea to keep parents happy too?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I really feel like I actually make parents' music. I think about a family in a car who is hungry and tired and hot and irritable, and I literally put myself in that car as I write, record, and mix and arrange these albums. I keep going back to, is this going to help that family? Is that banjo too prickly? You know, and I'll just erase it and say, yep, there it is. Oh, now the song is breathing and it can help.
You know, Chris, I listened to that song and there's something wonderfully new and wonderfully familiar about it. Is that a way that you're approaching this music?
Absolutely. I find myself listening to a lot of music from before the turn of the century, slave chants, prison songs, blues, old folk music, and finding that there's a nature to that music that is about saving your soul. You know, sometimes that music was the difference between life and death, and those rhythms were the difference between making it that through that day and not. And I use some of those rhythms as foundations to build my own new songs from. I did a record called Sing Along. I think it was my sixth or fifth record. I took a lot of the grooves and the setups from old call and response music from, like, you know, prison songs and stuff like that. So, yeah, I know being a parent is a little bit like being in a penitentiary in 1887.
Are you a bad blue jay?
Yes, sir.
Did you scare away the birds?
Yes, sir.
Are they ever coming back?
No, no, no.
And their song be heard?
Tweet, tweet, tweet.
Are you a bad blue jay?
Yes, sir.
Are you pushy and loud?
Yes, sir.
Do you make a noise?
Chainsaw.
Could you turn it down?
No, no, no.
Are you a bad...
Well, let's go back and forth here with Casper Baby Pants and the Presidents of the United States of America, because your sixth studio album is going to be released next month. So we're going to hear another song from the grown-up part of your personality or guest band. This is Good Morning Tycoon.
pluck that guitar all day long. Never guilty, never wrong. Just enough money to buy some quality food. Life was so smooth. Then something clicked, we're not sure what. Got the gold, if you got the guts, let us get the check, cause we don't wanna be rude. That fancy alcohol stew, it was the leisure, let the pleasure come through. Good morning, tycoon. Good morning, tycoon. Surrounded by sawed oak and silver spoons. Good morning, tycoon. Good morning, tycoon. You want the sun, you settle for the silver moon. Silver moon, moon, moon.
You have been Casper Baby Pants now for 7 albums, making children's music. I'm wondering if all that time writing and playing music for kids has influenced your work for the Presidents at all. Does anything bleed through?
Yeah, that's interesting. I thought when we went in to record a couple of songs, I thought, can I bring the innocent Casper Baby Pants into the Presidents? I think the President's music I've learned from doing the Casper thing and having this other voice, I've learned the strength of the Presidents is when innocence rubs up against innuendo, which is in itself an innuendo. So when there's friction between the innocent sort of, you know, like a dune buggy or a kitty or a peach or a spider, an electric spider or whatever that is, when the friction is there between innocence and innuendo, that's when the band really comes to life. So although I thought at first I could go in and say, hey, could we just do really simple little innocent songs? I realized that our chemistry really comes from that reaction. Also, Casper, I need that because it's an opportunity for me not to kind of have the pressure to apply that level of innuendo.
Hi, so you get to play out this whole other part of yourself as a songwriter.
Yeah.
Do any of your band work with you on Casper Baby Pants, or are they two sort of distinct projects?
They're pretty distinct. The Casper thing is really a solo endeavor. I mean, I feel more like a sculptor almost than a musician when I'm working on that stuff. I have to find the song in the mess. You know, I'll start recording and I'll record everything and put, you know, all these instruments on a song. And then the trick is removing as much as possible. So it's a long sort of experimental process. And the trick with working with others in that scenario is people get attached to their parts. You know, if I want to erase the guitar completely in Casper, I just do it because it serves the song. Whereas in the Presidents, erasing the guitar part is a potential political disaster.
Well, that's so, it's so interesting because you describe the inspiration for this as something visual, as the energy and brightness and color of your wife's collages. How does the visual work with you in creating this Casper Baby Pants thing?
Oh, it's gigantic in both the Presidents and Casper Baby Pants. The best songs that I have are born from a vision in my mind of something hilarious or weird or just a crazy vision. You know, Lump, everybody says, what's Lump about? Well, listen to it, and that's what it's about.
Lump said alone.
That's what Lump was about, is just a woman in a house coat sitting in a river confusing the piranhas as they swim by, you know. For some reason, that's what I saw. And the best Casper songs are like that, too. You know, me describing something crazy that popped into my head.
I'm thinking now, Chris, about being a parent, driving with a kid, listening to songs over and over and over again, and you giving them something interesting to hang on to. But at the same time, kids are going to remember that forever. You know, 3- and 4-year-olds that have been listening to your music are now 10, and they're going to grow up. I'm wondering what you think of your musical legacy. I mean, are you going to be remembered longer for the Presidents of the United States or Casper Baby Pants?
I hope that both, you know, endure. I do kind of feel like the Casper thing is going to keep cycling around, because my hope is that these kids that are growing up with it now are then going to need it for their kids, you know, and it's going to start this kind of endless cycle of regeneration, which would be really, really satisfying.
Chris Ballew, frontman for the Seattle-based rock band The Presidents of the United States of America. He also makes music as the toddler rock icon Casper Baby Pants. Chris, what a pleasure to speak with you today.
Ah, thanks for having me. It's really nice to be able to kind of talk about the stuff that goes behind the scenes on this music, so I appreciate it.
My little lumberjack, you don't want you back. In fact, I never want you to leave. My heart was falling.
Casper Baby Pants' most recent album is called Baby Beatles, and you can find out more about it and the new record coming out next month from the Presidents of the United States of America, all at wordofmouthradio.org. And we're going to leave you with one of the songs from the new record. This is called Poor Little Me.
Poor, so poor because of sheep. Carved a name into my loving tree. Climbed up to the top so she could see.
Many of us listen to children's music and think, well, anybody could write that, just a bunch of silly lyrics and a bunch of simple little riffs. Well, it just so happens our producer, Taylor Quimby, was once an amateur rocker in his own right. Now he is married and father to a 2-year-old son whose own musical tastes are just blossoming. So we decided to put him up to a little creative challenge to try his hand at writing a kid's song. So last week, he and producer Zach Nugent went into the NHPR studio to begin brainstorming some ideas.
The song is written, I guess, from the perspective of a little boy who is friends, and I don't know if they're imaginary friends or not, but, you know, he's friends with a pirate in the tub, and then there's a monster in his closet. They're all, you know, a benevolent monster. And then it's going to be, you know, the chorus will be all about, like, friendship, maybe, and, like, fun stuff about friendship.
So are these all toys?
I don't know. I mean, I don't think that kind of stuff matters so much.
There's a pirate in the tub, he sails a rubber duck. He commandeered the soap and I helped him wash his beard and his hook.
What did you think? Two verses and then chorus? I mean, kid songs move quick.
Yeah, I mean, and those are quick verses too, so I think you could do one more.
One more. They can help you eat broccoli, help you, you know, like, help you eat broccoli, high
chorus.
Fives, wiggy wiggy whack, wiggy dooby doop, dooby dooby doop, doop friends.
But I can't think of any, like, good friends words.
The Bens. Yeah, it
depends.
Lens.
There's no, like, good friends words. Friends.
Friends can be anything, can be anyone. We'll be together, la la la, libby libby labby labaloo.
Is it because I'm just changing the chords so much that... Will it be weird? I mean, maybe it's cool that it's weird. Kids' music can be weird.
I don't think it's that weird.
Producer Taylor Quimby with Zach Nugent there in the, I don't know, I guess your work thrashing through the creative process. So, Taylor, you had a whole weekend to work on the song. What'd you come up with?
Well, you know, it was really hard, and I think... We made things much more complicated than I think they probably needed to be. You know, it's hard because when you're writing for a kid, I think you want it to be simple, but at the same time you want to satisfy your own musical ambitions. We wrote more song than I could actually use. And then we tried to record it, and then we were putting, like, layers of instruments on top. I did this guitar track, and it was, like, really serious and weird and not fun or kiddish at all. I was like, this is like an adult... hipster folk song with really silly lyrics. And so I don't know. It was hard. I think, you know, we figured something out, and then I came back and I laid it all out and I just tried to have fun with it and not worry so much.
So what did you call it in the end? And which one of those tracks did you follow that you were talking about with Zach?
I used a little bit of each, I think. And I don't have a name for it, so I was going to maybe ask for suggestions from listeners. You know, it could be just called Friends or I'm Friends with a Pirate or... something completely...
Wiki-wacky-wacky-wacky.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, listeners, this is your challenge. You can hear Taylor's song for kids and help him to name it. This is Taylor's song.
There's a pirate in the tub. He sails a rubber duck. He commandeered the soap. I helped him wash his hair and his beard.
Yar, conditioned.
There's a monster in my closet, he needs some extra clothes. His fuzzy wuzzy toes, they grow and grow and grow. O-E-O.
Socks.
There's a teeny tiny spaceman, he crash landed, crash landed, crash landed. In my room, on my bed, on his head. Friends can be anything, can be anyone. A frog on a log, a flea on a dog, a beaver in a bog, and an ice cream cone.
Friends.
A truck, a boat, a castle in a moat, a stick in a puddle, and a blue billy goat.
Friends.
A poodle with a noodle in a blizzard of cheese, a sock in a shoe, a chewy sneeze. Friends can be anything, can be anyone.
Taylor, that's just adorable.
Well, you know, it's not kid tested yet. I still have to take it home and play it for my son.
What would pass the kid test as far as you're concerned?
Well,
he wants to hear it a second time?
If he runs around the house in a circle, you know, puts his hands up in the air and wants to hear it, you know, 30, 40 times in a row, that means it's a hit.
Taylor, I'm so impressed that you did that in just a couple of days, especially, you know, all of the layered vocals and everything. And I hope it inspires other people to, I don't know, just try a creative project. That sounds like a good thing to do at the beginning of a new year.
Yeah, no, it is. I think branching out and trying to do something different. You know, I think trying to make kids' music might sound like a task that a lot of serious musicians might balk at. But it's interesting, and there's a series of limitations that you couldn't really imagine, you know. Trying to balance the aesthetic tastes of both parents and kids, it's worth trying just because it's such a challenge, and it'll put you in a really different place.
Word of Mouth's Taylor Quimby, there on vocals, ukulele, kazoo, and egg shaker. Words and music by Taylor and producer Zach Nugent. You can get a free download of the song and help us name it. Details are at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Throughout the world, hundreds of caves have been discovered that contain artifacts and paintings from prehistoric times. Werner Herzog explored one of the most famous, Francis Chauvet Cave, in his documentary, Cave of Forgotten Dreams.
These images are memories of long-forgotten dreams. Is this their heartbeat or ours? Will we ever be able to understand the vision of the artists across such an abyss of time?
The artwork found in these caves has provided a glimpse into prehistoric culture, but anthropological archaeologist Margaret Conkey says they only tell part of the story of early humans. For her project, Between the Caves, she's pushed archaeological research beyond caves into the landscapes where Paleolithic people lived and thrived. Margaret Conkey is Professor Emerita of Anthropology at the University of California, Berkeley. Margaret Conkey, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Tell us about the significance of the name of your project, Between the Caves.
Well, we all know that cave people, cavemen, of course, have been part of a stereotypical notion of what our prehistoric past might have been like. And indeed, it is based, in fact, that there are caves that were occupied and used and excavated, and they're wonderful locations for excavation. But of course, there were many things that prehistoric peoples did that really were not in the caves. People did not live in the caves on a year-round basis. They moved about from resource area to resource area, and for social and cultural reasons as well. So our project was inspired by the idea to think about what people did when they weren't in caves, where they went, how they got their firewood, how they connected up with other people for mating, for cultural and social reasons. We have a number of archaeological sites which indicate that large groups came together at least occasionally to exchange mates, to socialize, and expand their networks of trade and exchange and society. So we decided, well, how are we going to find out about these? So we took an area in the foothills of the French Pyrenees, somewhere between Toulouse and the Andorra, charted out a triangular, rectangular area, and with a very well-known cave at the eastern end and a well-known painted cave at the western end, and just set out to find out what we could find from the fields, the open fields that had been plowed off and on over the millennia by farmers, to see if there were any traces. By now, we've collected over 6,000 artifacts dating to the Paleolithic period, some of which go back to more than 100,000 years.
You mentioned that your research has revealed clues to Paleolithic societies gathering, meeting with each other. What else does it reveal about how they migrated or survived?
Right. Well, we know that they were mobile, that mobility from season to season or region to region was definitely a way of life. But we also know they had amazing long-distance contacts. And actually, this is well established from the very beginning of the occupation of Europe by anatomically modern humans, where we find shells that are only coming from the Mediterranean way into the western part of Europe. And we find shells and other things, shark's teeth and so forth, from the Atlantic that are found hundreds of kilometers away. And we know right at our site alone at Peira Blanca, we're finding uses of flint, which is a raw material that can be characterized and identified as coming from 200 kilometers to the north. So we know these people were moving, objects were moving, people were moving, and along with that, of course, ideas were moving, culture was moving, social relationships were really the ties, literally, that bind and held a small group societies together over many thousands of years.
One of the things that you identified in your finding is a suggestion of sites called places of many generations, which just seems so evocative and wonderful to me as a term, and I'm wondering what that means.
Well, what we've taken it to mean is that in our survey, walking these cornfields, these vineyards of a beautiful part, I must say, of southern France, we have often found in the same location artifacts that are characteristic and well-known and accepted by archaeologists as being attributable to the handiwork of Neanderthal populations, which were in the area from maybe 100,000 years ago to maybe 35,000 years ago. And on top of those, or mixed in with them, we find artifacts that are characteristic of anatomically modern humans who moved into the region probably around 35 or 40,000 years ago. And so what we see is that even people of different biological groupings with different stone tool making traditions are visiting and using and being at the same location. And, you know, these people were well aware of what kinds of artifacts individuals or other groups were making. And so it's interesting to think about anatomically modern humans coming to a place, looking at the ground and seeing the remains, the stone tools left by not just, you know, their grandparents, but if they knew them, but by a whole different cultural and biological and technological group. So, and then we do see that through the Upper Paleolithic, which is what we call the period related to anatomically modern humans, that is between, say, 35, 40,000 years and 10,000 years ago, and even into the Neolithic after that, we see continued use of some of these locations by people making slightly different kinds of stone tools. So it just makes us think about what was significant about these places, and was it even just the presence of previous people that made them an interesting and significant place to be?
Margaret Conkey, you mentioned the sort of old image of cavemen or cave dwellers that has stuck in our imagination. And we often do think of early humans as other, very, very far removed from modern humans. What does your big picture research reveal about human nature, the way we communicate, move, and express ourselves?
Well, I think the work, especially in the time period and the locations where we are working, as well as in others, for ourselves, anatomically modern humans, shows quite clearly that we use the material world. We imbue meaning into materials. These people were making all sorts of objects out of bone and antler. They had created a visual culture, something that provided a link for them between themselves and the spiritual worlds, which surely they engaged with. They had hopes, fears, anxieties, anger, and warm feelings, just like we do. They were very, very successful for many, many millennia, which is maybe more than we're going to be able to say about ourselves in the long run. And I think that we have tended all too often to limit our understanding of their lives and experiences to the what we think of as the available information, the available archaeological data. So caves and hacking out stone tools and spearing animals has tended to be a kind of a limited understanding of what these people were all about, when it's clear from their abilities to move around the landscape, to know their resources. And when we see what they could do with materials, they knew how you could use ochres and manganeses and how you could use bone and antler. They knew the principles and properties of materials in ways that I think few of us actually understand. So I think what we need to do is remember these people were like us. They had these broad human experiences that led to the kinds of rich human experiences that have evolved and radiated outwards since their time.
Margaret Conkey, Professor Emerita of Anthropology at UC Berkeley, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. I enjoyed talking with you.
Until last week, you may never have heard of a polar vortex. That is, unless you happen to see the 2004 film The Day After Tomorrow.
Mr. Vice President, if we don't act now, it's going to be too late.
I'm afraid that time has come and gone, my friend.
What can we do?
Save as many as you can.
Okay, so maybe last week wasn't that bad, but it did get pretty darn frigid and got us wondering, how did Polar Vortex 2014 stack up against previous cold snaps? And who decides when a storm is a superstorm or a blizzard worthy of being given a name anyway? Helping to separate the sensational from the sensible is Jason Salmonow, weather editor for The Washington Post and chief meteorologist for the Capital Weather Gang. Jason, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So the term polar vortex was not invented in January 2014. Why hadn't we heard of one up until now?
Yeah, actually, the term polar vortex has been around since the 1940s when it first appeared in the meteorological literature. And it's real. It's both in the northern hemisphere on the North Pole and in the southern hemisphere on the South Pole. And it's here all winter long. It's here even in the summer, but it just kind of shrinks down and gets weaker. Obviously, in the winter when it's colder, that's when it grows and intensifies. And sometimes, if it gets strong enough, pieces of it can break off and drop down into North America and even into the United States.
Another term that got introduced to us last week, snowquakes. First, explain that, and how long has that term been around?
Right. So snowquakes happen, or ice quakes are sometimes called, when you have a warm ground and then it suddenly freezes. The ground then expands and you get a bit of an earthquake type sensation. Sometimes there are sonic booms associated with those. They're somewhat rare and more of just a spectacle or odd atmospheric phenomenon. Nothing too hazardous, fortunately.
This particular polar vortex, very, very cold, Midwest and Eastern Seaboard, but not as cold as some might have predicted. How did it stack up against other cold spells?
Sure. So this particular cold spell was probably the coldest since 1996 or 1994. So obviously one of the coldest in a couple of decades. But when we look at the historic record, when we look at the 1980s, 70s, and even if we go further back to the late 1800s, this cold wave was not remarkable at all. And in fact, if we look at temperature trends over time, we see a warming trend. We see a gradual reduction in the intensity of these cold waves, and they're becoming further spaced apart over time. So whereas in the late 1800s, these types of events were happening every few years, we're now seeing them now at an interval of maybe every 10 to 20 years. So they're definitely becoming less intense and more spaced out.
We here in New England remember the nor'easter that hit last February. Now, this was nicknamed Nemo by the Weather Channel. The Weather Channel's decision to start naming storms last year was pretty controversial. I'm wondering what you and meteorologist circles thought of it.
Right. Well, there's a little bit of controversy simply from the standpoint that there's some people in the weather community who feel like the Weather Channel is, in a way, trying to play God or trying to take over the world of weather by naming storms and basically taking ownership. Why should the Weather Channel be the entity that's naming storms? Why not the National Weather Service? From my standpoint, here the Capital Weather Gang, we're the DC's weather blog. We actually name significant storms when they affect the region locally, but we try to get reader input and get suggestions for storm names and try to have some locally relevant term. In March, we had we named the storm March 6th the Snowquester, so that obviously resonated pretty well. But we try to give a storm a name which has some meaning, whereas the Weather Channel's names they're just sort of arbitrarily assigned. Personally, I don't have any problem with the Weather Channel naming storms if they want to do it and their audience finds it entertaining and useful. But there are some folks within the meteorological community who there's a bit of resentment or maybe jealousy going on there, perhaps.
Well, and maybe confusion for we, the watchers. I mean, it's very difficult for us to be able to discern the legitimate big superstorm that we should prepare for that might pose a threat and whether that's just being sort of trumped up or hyped so people will stay tuned in. How do we tell the difference?
I think it's up to the individual to be a judicious consumer of weather information and to critically look at the weather information which is provided and then determine who they trust. And I think if people do that, then they won't be misled and they won't necessarily buy into the hype as much.
When you've warned people about the flaky Facebook forecasts that proliferate on social media. So is part of the problem that people don't really think about vetting their weather sources, or we just assume that a weather forecast is a weather forecast?
I think there's some truth to that. There certainly is a growing contingent of what I call armchair meteorologists on Facebook who are posting hype-filled forecasts for storms maybe 7 to 10 days into the future, when really when we look at forecasts that far ahead of time, there's not a lot of skill and predictability. We're really only able to provide credible forecasts within about 3 to 5 days.
How about 45 days? You've been critical of the website AccuWeather, which actually offers 45-day forecasts.
Right. So I think AccuWeather has excellent meteorologists. They provide really good forecasts in the short range. But where I have a philosophical difference with them, and a lot of people in the meteorological community have taken issue with the fact that they're trying to predict the weather beyond a point at which the weather is really predictable. You take an average high 10 days from now, it's maybe 45, the low is 28 here in D.C. That's about as likely to be right as the AccuWeather 10-day forecast, and especially when you go out to 45 days. That's just absurd.
So, Jason, we have a plenty of armchair meteorologists. It seems that this polar vortex also brought out a number of armchair climate change experts. What do you see in that kind of assertion of either this being evidence of climate change or the non-existence of climate change?
Yeah, well, I think it's really misleading. You can't point to an individual weather event in a particular region and try to link it to climate change, because climate change is about looking at long-term trends over large regions. And when we look at that, we see an unmistakable trend towards warming. Now, on the flip side, you asked about, well, people saying, well, you know, this cold wave is actually evidence of global warming and climate change. And there's a theory out there that basically climate change by melting Arctic ice is going to cause the polar vortex to weaken. And when the polar vortex is weakened, the jet stream, which is underneath it, tends to become more wavy and meanders more, and that can lead to more extreme weather. So what we might see in the future as we look into the coming decades is more variability in the weather, because if this polar vortex is in fact weakening, that might make the jet stream a little bit more erratic and more variable. But I think when we look at cold weather overall, we're still likely to see less of it because as these heat-trapping gases continue to build up in the atmosphere, that's going to put a lot of pressure on these cold air outbreaks.
Jason Samenow, weather editor at The Washington Post, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Thank you for spending some time with Word of Mouth today. We hope you continue to come back throughout the month for our Rethink 2014 series. Is there something you're rethinking this year? A way of operating that you've been taking for granted and ready to change? You can tell us what you're rethinking on our Facebook page, wordofmouthradio.org, or on Twitter, @wordofmouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us again for more conversations we came upon by Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Zach Nugent,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
To subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio.
Follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth.
And check out a playlist of music from the program on Spotify.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.